Welcome to ESAB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm speaking to Roland Freudenstein. Roland is the policy director at the Wilfrid Martin Center for European Studies here in Brussels. He's a speaker, writer, and researcher, and the author of several papers on Europe, European integration, and international security. He's been in the think tank Cosmos for a long time, and before coming to Brussels, he had stints at the German Council on Foreign Relations and the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. He's also been in public service, working for the Hamburg State Government and the European Commission. I'm going to talk to Roland about Europe in the world, Europe's position in an increasingly fractious world, and Europe's relation to the United States and how that relation may change or not. But first, I will ask Roland about the election to the European Parliament and if it really is the case that this election is a title fight between liberalism and nationalism. Roland, welcome to ESAB's podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So we are going to talk about a few issues in this podcast, and I'm going to lead off with the issue of the election to the European Parliament, which is coming up pretty soon. We are just a few weeks away from it now. And over the past couple of months, I think we've already seen quite clearly what type of debate that at least a lot of people want to have about this election. So we see, for instance, a lot of people thinking about the election as being this big title fight between liberalism and nationalism. And we're going to have a debate between good and evil or light and darkness. Now, I have a problem with that view. I think it's simplistic, and I don't think it captures the true differences in views in European politics, let alone being relevant for the type of policy platform that the European Parliament represents. Now, Roland, where did I get this wrong?
Well, you didn't get it entirely wrong, but let me start with who is interested in making it look like this is the ultimate struggle between open and closed worldviews in Europe, i.e. between good and evil, or black and white, white and black. Now, I think there's a whole bunch of nativists, nationalists, populists, sovereignists, whatever you want to call them, who see that their political fates have been on the upswing recently, and who have a high interest in actually making this appear like a struggle between two basic philosophies about European civilization. You know, on the one hand, the globalized elites who want to keep borders open for goods as well as for people, who are essentially in favor of migration and so on, and the others, the nativists who want Europe to remain as it used to be, because they're very nostalgic about past decades, and they would actually like to keep it white and Christian. So, you know, to make a long story short, the second group certainly has an interest in making it look like this is so, but there's also some liberals who would like to make this election look like a struggle between good and evil. Of course, in their worldview, the white and the black and the good and the evil are slightly differently distributed than in the worldview of the nativists, needless to say. Even though some people look at it this way, some people would like to make this this kind of Manichaean struggle, I think you're basically right in saying that things are much more complicated in this election.
So what are the complications that we're dealing with then?
The fact that migration, the question whether we need more or fewer migrants or whether we should have safe borders and so on, is the number one topic only in a few countries. Among them are Austria, France, Italy, but in most member states, people actually claim that they're voting in this European election according to other issues, whether it's education, housing, general economic perspectives, crime, climate change, and so on and so on. All these are topics that are very important to people, and in most countries more important than the issue of migration, which of course is the issue that the populists believe is going to be the number one thing that's going to decide everything. So this election, in their view, will be a referendum on migration, and it won't, very simply, because these other issues are more important to people. Is it going to be a referendum about anything? I doubt that. Certainly, you know, in the background, of course, the question of a more open Europe to both people, goods and ideas, and a more closed Europe do play a certain role. I mean, these are not irrelevant questions, but I dare say that they are not going to decide this election.
Yeah, no, I think I would agree with you on that point. And I think more broadly, my problem with this presentation of this election as being a big fight between liberalism and nationalism is that, in the first place, I don't think that the dividing lines between parties can easily find sort of a normal place on that scale. When you look at what's been going on with, for instance, the center-left in Europe, what's going on with the Greens in Europe, I think it's just very difficult to say that they represents liberalism and the other side represents nationalism on economic issues, if we start with that and look at what's happened on issues around trade. I think we've seen the growth of a new type of economic populism that has certainly been reinforced at the same time as many people, sort of many parties on the center-left have shrunk and become so much smaller than they were in the past, and they don't try to be this catch-all parties that they were 20 years ago, which also felt a responsibility to, you know, on issues like, you know, trade or industrial policy to represent something that that could broadly be defined as being liberalism. So it's not just sort of on the sort of populist nationalist side that we've seen developments. We've also seen developments on other side of the political scale, and I just don't see this debate being sort of relevant to the sort of the actual policy conflicts that we have here.
Yeah, I think it was definitely premature. A couple of years ago, I remember a cover story of The Economist Weekly saying from now on it's open versus closed. And it was definitely premature a couple of years ago to declare this and to declare the old left-right divide as totally 20th century. To paraphrase those pundits at the time. So I think some of the good old left-right divide of the 20th century is remaining with us now. And let me give you an example. The question of centralism versus subsidiarity. Subsidiarity, we know, is a buzzword of actually the Catholic social teachings of the 19th century, but you know, translated into the 20th and 21st century, it very simply means that better than the classical centralist approach of the left, of the socialists mainly, but also some nationalists, is an approach which is truly federalist. In other words, you know, the federation, the power center, needs to be bigger on the big things, but also smaller on the small things that are much better dealt with closer to the citizens. And this is the core of what we call subsidiarity. In other words, to solve every problem at the appropriate level, but as a general rule, as closely as possible to the citizens themselves. And you know, this is a classical left-right, or let's say center-left versus center-right debate that we're having here. The center-left was always more centralist and believed in a more a concentrated form of governance where the center decides everything that happens in the periphery, whereas subsidiarity is the essence of strong regions, strong constituents of a whole. And I think this debate is very well translatable into the debate on the future of the European Union and its institutions. You know, again, we have the classical left-right question. Is it more like the socialist-centralist approach where Brussels institutions decide as much as possible? Or is it a more classical federalist approach where, of course, the nation states have certain prerogatives and certainly the regions and the local communities as well?
Yeah, and what I would add to that is basically if we want to have a political development in Europe over the foreseeable future where we rehabilitate the center and makes it far more difficult for the extremes to be relevant parties in our broader debate, we have to create opportunities for the center left and the center right to make those differences central. And
Absolutely.
if we sort of try to collect everyone under an umbrella saying we're all liberals and now we're going to fight AfD or Salvini or Le Pen, then I think we're making a disservice to our own ability in order to actually connect with voters and make
Totally.
them understand what the
Yeah.
relevant differences are.
You know, the Salvinis and Le Pens have a high interest in painting every political conflict as the globalized elite versus the real people. Of course, they put themselves on the side of the real people in this narrative. And I think at the same time, the competitors of the Salvinis and Le Pens have a very high interest in not framing things in this way. In other words, to leave some space for the old left-right questions or the center versus the periphery or centralism versus a true federalism. On all these questions, the nationalists and the sovereignists have very little constructive to say. And I think people are beginning to realize that in many cases, and are beginning to realize that these populist forces actually have limited governing capabilities. There are some exceptions of governments that may have more longevity in countries like Poland and Hungary, where actually populists have now formed a national elite of their own and still manage to present themselves as anti-elitist, but that's the exception. In most cases, populists in power are not governing so well, and it will be very interesting to see what's happening in Italy in like 2, 3 years down the line.
Indeed, absolutely. Let's move on to another populist or sovereignist, but one who actually is president of the United States of America,
Yes.
and talk a little bit about transatlantic relations. So I have, of late, I think I've detected sort of a new type of narrative, as they call it these days, in Europe, when it comes to America, which is that, look, our relations to America are now permanently fractured, partly as a consequence of Donald Trump, partly as a consequence of many other things. We can no longer build sort of a broad alliance, a broad cooperation together with America. We need to forge out our own independent view in Europe and, as a consequence of that, release ourselves from some of the pressures that we've had in our transatlantic relations in the past. So,
Well,
what's your view on that issue?
I think it's nonsense. It's nonsense for 3 reasons. First of all, it doesn't really correspond to reality, to the reality of American policy. I mean, okay, the devil is in the detail, of course. The devil is in your interpretation or definition of certain terms. I do agree that the Atlantic Alliance won't be what it used to be, but frankly speaking, even under Obama or under George W. Bush for that matter, it wasn't what is considered like the good old times. I think the last time Europe was perfectly happy with the US president and the Transatlantic Alliance seemed to be going forward and on the winning side of history was actually under Bill Clinton. But having said this, now look at the current US government and what it is doing for European security. Don't look at Trump's tweets. Look at what the US government is doing in terms of military spending and in terms of military deployment. So there you have the whole NATO Eastern Forward Presence, enhanced forward presence, which has been tremendously strengthened in the now 2.5, almost 2.5 years of Donald Trump as president, despite his putting in doubt the Article 5 security guarantee for the Allies and so on and so on. So what I would say is that, first of all, what the president says may have some consequences in terms of making Putin triumph rhetorically and and creating insecurity in Europe. But if you look at the facts on the ground, they talk a completely different language. And the US actually is now a good ally and certainly a better ally than in some cases under President Obama. And besides that, even the White House, even the president as commander in chief, does not make America's security and defense policy alone. There is Congress, there are the states, there are media, there are the courts, there are checks and balances, even in foreign policy, to whatever the president feels like is right for the nation. And in that sense, I think we should all be a bit more confident on the United States actually staying course on transatlantic relations. Now, the second point is, look at Europe itself. How united is Europe on the line that you actually sketched out? I think in Western Europe, you find a lot of people, especially in Paris, but also here in Brussels, less so in Berlin. But in, yes, it is true. In some places in Western Europe, you find people who are saying that we, from now on, we have to take our fate into our own hands. And the fact that Donald Trump has become president of the United States means Europeans have to take care of their own security from now on. But look at the whole eastern flank, and the story is a very different one. You don't see anyone in the Baltic countries, in Poland, in Romania, even in Prague, and in other Central European countries. You see very few people who are actually repeating this narrative that in their eyes is very West European. And Europe, you know, as someone recently said, in Europe where you stand on security and defense depends on where you sit on the map. And in other words, most of the Eastern Flank countries don't actually believe that Europe can ever be fully independent and deterring a power like Russia on the hybrid, on the conventional, on the tactical nuclear, and on the strategic nuclear level on its own. So in other words, I think we will need the United States. And third, I actually do believe that indeed, if Europe smartly enhances its capabilities in defense and its also its involvement overseas in military operations, if Europe smartly enhances command and control capacities in the European Union that can work without or outside of NATO, I think we can actually strengthen the transatlantic alliance. You know, so in other words, for me, it is not an alternative question. Is it either the transatlantic alliance or a militarily independent Europe? I would say that a Europe which uses its resources and capacities more smartly will actually strengthen the transatlantic alliance, and the transatlantic alliance has a great future.
Do you think this issue is going to become important over the next couple of years, taking into account, for instance, that when the member states voted on whether the Commission was going to get a mandate in order to negotiate a new trade agreement with America over the next couple of years, there was actually one country who voted against and one country that abstained. And the country voting against was France.
Yeah.
And they voted against on at least the argument that the EU shouldn't do any trade agreement with a country that has not ratified or signed the Paris Accord on climate change.
Well, that was one reason, yeah.
Exactly. And then the parliament had their own vote a couple of weeks ago on this trade agreement as well, and they also couldn't find sort of a majority in favor of it. So, I mean, I think sort of it's not just reading tea leaves here, but I think sort of the question becomes, is this going to become sort of a highly controversial issue over the next couple of years? America has always been controversial in Europe, but are we now about to enter a period when it's going to be even more controversial?
Yes. Well, let me come back to what I just interjected briefly. I think the Paris Climate Accord question was one of the reasons why France rejected this mandate. The other one was very simply the yellow vests. You know, you have a groundswell of anti-globalist protest at the moment in France, stronger than in any other European Union member state, and more violent and more in itself contradictory. with basically unfulfillable demands because they are so contradictory. So France is in a special situation here, and that's not to apologize for the French position, but it's to explain it. I think indeed trade under President Trump has become a new transatlantic battleground, which it hadn't been to that extent beforehand. But let's not forget that even before the election of Donald Trump, the protests against TTIP were much stronger in Europe than in the United States. There is, of course, a whole bunch of strongly rooted anti-American prejudices, such as that, American goods are of low quality, that they're bad for consumers, that they're bad for ecological reasons, and that for all these reasons, Europe should not let as many American goods into Europe, and certainly should not perform what was TTIP's main innovation, a regulatory convergence between Europe and the United States. And I still believe that, well, first of all, the fact that this regulatory convergence was such a hot topic was a result of the fact that trade between the two sides of the Atlantic is already pretty free. The exchange of goods, of course, provided they fulfill the rules and regulations of the other side, is already tariffs are very low. Trade is extremely strong. This is the strongest economic bond in the world between two regions. So all this is going all right. And the fact that in order to improve anything and in order to still increase economic well-being through trade, what you would need would be some kind of regulatory convergence. And, the sad fact about regulatory convergence of any kind is this. As soon as you try to negotiate it, the first thing that both sides become aware of is their actual differences. Is the differences in regulation, because you're trying to tackle those in the negotiations. And so in the end, I think for the moment, we just have to recognize that, President Trump notwithstanding, I think we are in a certain degree of populist-induced protectionism here in Europe. And so are the United States to an extent. And we'll just have to wait for this to cool down a little bit before we can actually take the next step forward.
Let's move to international affairs and foreign policy outside the realm of EU and United States. So we've had for at least the entire time I have watch pretty closely European affairs, there has been this big debate about Europe's own strategic capacities, both in terms of infrastructural capacities defined in military terms, but also strategic capacity in its own analysis about its place in the world and its capacity to orient itself in a world which is changing. Do you think that we have been moving in the right direction here in Europe over the past couple of years, that we are sort of finally getting to a point where we actually behave a bit more strategically than we used to do?
I mean, I would like to believe so, but we've had a couple of factors that are really complicating the picture, if not spoiling the party. One is Brexit, obviously, the fact that Britain is leaving the European Union, and that for any kind of security relationship outside of NATO, of course, or in parallel to NATO, that the European Union wants to have, we have to negotiate special agreements and so on. And with the foreseeable acrimony which is coming with Brexit chaos and so on, this looks very difficult. So Brexit is one factor. The other, even more important, and I'd say even sadder part of the picture is Germany, is my country, where there is a total absence of strategic thinking and drawing the right conclusions, both from history and from the current global situation, and drawing the conclusions in the sense of then, of course, increasing defense spending and increasing our willingness to participate in military operations abroad and overseas. Germany is the richest, the biggest, the most powerful nation in the European Union, and the our tanks don't shoot, our ships aren't seaworthy, our planes don't fly. The situation of the Bundeswehr is completely, dismally tragic, especially set against the backdrop of Germany's economic strength. And this is the major stumbling block for an enhanced role of the European Union, of Europe, also Europe inside NATO, in terms of security and defense. Contrary to my optimism of a couple of minutes ago, when it comes to Germany, some major change would have to happen. I haven't completely given up hope yet. We may see maybe a step forward when the next chancellor gets into office, and that may actually happen very soon. That would be Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer instead of Angela Merkel. But there is no guarantee it will happen. And Germany, unfortunately, largely has drawn the wrong conclusions from history, and therefore is not a constructive force in this European effort to be stronger, to use its resources better for defense and security.
There is, I think, an even more pessimistic case that you can also make here, and I just wanted to test you on this one. So one line of argument could go like this. So for Europe right now, we have quite recently appointed China to be our systemic rival in the world. At the same time, Europe broadly has no position at all sort of in the broader geostrategic changes that are happening in the Asian region.
Yeah.
We have chaos close to our borders. We don't really have any strategy for our relations with Turkey. We don't have any strategy for our relations with the Middle East, apart from doing a couple of desperate attempts in order to protect the Iran agreement. Our borders towards Northern Africa is getting even more complicated. And even if we should have sort of a big strategic orientation here towards Africa, we don't seem to talk about these issues. The only thing that of interest when it comes to Africa right now is to avoid more refugees coming to the shores of Europe.
Yeah,
and then of course we have Russia, and Russia, we don't really seem to know what to do with it. We have the sanctions. Perhaps they're going to be rolled over again. Perhaps they won't, and we're going to see some countries refusing to do that. But in sort of beyond that, we don't have a broader strategy for how we're going to deal with Russia.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, some people set off Russia against China, saying that why aren't we nicer to Putin so he'll be nicer to us and recognize that his future is rather with the West against China? I think that's completely mistaken, by the way, because China and Russia are part of the same struggle with authoritarianism or aggressive authoritarianism, only that the Chinese are a little bit smarter than the Russians. But it's true that the big struggle in the long run is the struggle against China. It's a civilizational one about democracy, freedom, individual choice, and so on. But if we don't get Russia right, we can forget about standing up to China. That's the way I see it. And Chinese are observing very closely how we deal with Russia. Now, as you... I don't completely share your pessimism about the Europeans' perspectives in dealing with Russia. I think we have held out amazingly long with the sanctions, for example, and I believe we'll hold out quite a while longer, very simply because Putin, as smart as he is on the tactical level, as much he has underestimated the West and will continue to do so on the strategic level. And he's doing everything to prove time and again that he is an extremely dangerous adversary to whom you can only talk on the basis of strength. And I think so by and large, we're not only holding the line on this, I think we also will for some time in the future. I don't see this front against Russia, against an aggressive Russia crumbling very quickly. Even though, of course, the sovereignists and the populists would like to cooperate much more closely with Russia, and some of them actually see Russia as the better West, which in their eyes has been taken over by, you know, George Soros and the LGBT rights mafia, as they would call it. But okay, so I think on Russia we're holding up nicely for the moment. The fact that we don't have a Middle Eastern strategy and we don't really know what to do with Turkey, you know, you could still say the glass is half full rather than half empty. I mean, we've struck a deal with Turkey. We don't break off membership talks, although no one believes that membership is on the cards for this Turkish government, but for the sake of Turkish civil society, and because we don't want to grant Erdogan this triumph of being the one who gets the door slammed in his face by the European Union, I think for all these reasons we're not breaking off membership talks, so they go on at infinitum, and we still try to use the little bit of leverage that we still have to somehow support human rights and certain standards of rule of law in Turkey. You know, better to have this instrument than not having it. And finally, yes, on the Middle East, you're right. You may say that we have nothing more to say than kind of humanitarian aid for Syria and clinging on to the JCPOA with Iran, but I think that's for another day. To have a coherent Middle Eastern strategy will actually take much, much more time. And for the moment, this is just inachievable. So we'll have the big powers in Europe, France, Germany, to an extent Britain, even after Brexit, doing their own and forming coalitions of the willing wherever they can.
And finally, Roland, talking about one of the issues that you mentioned, which is also part of international affairs these days, Brexit. I'm not going to ask you what you think is going to happen, because no one knows, and we're all getting a bit sick and tired of it all. Do you think that Europe will continue to take the position that we're not going to force Britain out? We're not going to say, well, you couldn't ratify what we've negotiated, therefore we're going to kick you out?
I don't see a single head of government in the European Union that wants to bear the mark of the one who pushed Britain out finally. Even Macron is shying away from this, although he tried to be as tough on Britain as possible at the last summit of the European Union. Nevertheless, I do think that this state of affairs can last quite a while. What I personally do not see happening is Britain joining as a completely normal member state in the next couple of years, as the Remainers would have it. Some of my Remainer friends actually say that, look, we'll be a better and more constructive Britain inside the European Union than ever, ever, ever before. I don't believe it. I think that British society is so divided. I think that British politics has to so reinvent itself that I don't see that country playing a positive role and actually rejoining under the same conditions under which it left. So actually, I think some time in the cooler would actually be a good thing, not only for the European Union, but for Britain itself. And I have not given up hope that some kind of agreement can be reached, which will have to be very similar to the current one on the table. It's just that it probably hasn't dawned upon enough members of parliament yet that this is the best deal Britain can get. And I would give it some more time, if only half a year or so, for that idea to sink in the House of Commons, and then maybe to create a majority for the current deal.
Roland, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.